4. It is cold the next day. Of course it is cold the next day. They are in the Arctic. But they sometimes have days of glorious sunshine. The stewards hang the laundry on ropes outstretched from the rigging. At least one man aboard Erebus has red flannel underwear. Gore, taking McClure's decade-old advice, wears leather breeches beneath wool. The sunny days also induce snow blindness, as the summer rays bounce up from the ice like a tossed knife. The broad emptiness of the landscape, seascape rather, they are locked in pack ice, makes sound and movement travel weirdly. Taking a daily constitutional around the ship is to risk hallucination, to see hordes of assassins and phantom guests where a tin or a boot lies lumpen. Today, the weather is overcast and grumbling. Gore sets out over the frozen sea for King William Land by himself. He prefers this to hunting in company. He becomes, along the hallowing earth, a moving point of muscle and sinew, quite clean of thought. If he sees a quarry, he does not re-enter his body. He bends all his thought to the bullet. If there was someone with him, he'd have to remember he was fully inhabited by Graham Gore. On the 1836 Frozen Strait expedition, he'd once spent 10 hours on the ice, hoping to bag a seal. They had an unsporting habit of sinking once killed. This crazed feat of endurance had rendered him snowblind, which was the only thing that persuaded him back to the ship. That was 10 years ago, of course. He's older now. He's been behind cannons at sieges. He's had dysentery. His back aches in the mornings. He tends to return to Erebus when his body reminds him that they're the same person. On land, he shoots 2 brace of partridges, slack-feathered pouches that will barely thicken a soup. He keeps walking, intending to meet the next hillock, which always promises to be the highest until he attains it. No caribou, no muskoxen. Not even wolves enliven his natural history studies. He can't feel his feet. Each step has the unnatural pressure of blows in dreams. Perverse to admit it, but he rather enjoys this. He'll pay for it later, swelling like a waterlogged corpse when the frost nip kicks in. It's thirst that sends him homewards. He runs out of water within a couple of hours. When he takes a pull of brandy from the flask, the freezing metal skims off a haze of skin. It is summer. He is lucky. If he'd tried drinking from a metal container in January, he'd have a divot in his lip. The frozen waves are piled against the shore of King William Land, like the walls of a collapsing temple. He has to use the pick to let himself down the other side, scrambling for footholds with his numb feet. He's seen etchings of the Arctic in the Illustrated London News. Flat, a washed sheet landscape beneath a grey sky. But the northern seas are full of teeth. They're crazy with pressure ridges and treacherous drifts. It will take him more than an hour to reach the ships, though the distance would take perhaps 20 minutes at a brisk walk across a lawn. The sky lowers itself to the earth as he toils across the floes. A storm is coming, squeezing the visibility out of the air. Gore notes this dispassionately. Either he'll make it back to the ship, or he won't. He would like to survive until he can have a cup of cocoa, but he takes care not to visualize the cocoa too indulgently. Fitzjames had once asked him how he could approach life-threatening peril and minor annoyances with the same mildness, and he shrugged. It doesn't improve my mood to catastrophize, so I don't. And what about hope? Have you ever been in love, Graham? Fitzjames had asked. Ever lived for the bestowment of a fair smile? Ah, love. Life's greatest catastrophe. The wind picks up. The gelid light hurts his eyes. He pulls back even from thinking about his cup of cocoa and sets his mind exactly on top of his head. 1 foot in front of the other. Swing, push. Swing, push. He is in this frame of mind, mindlessness rather, when he sees a dark shape crouching by a black disc, a seal hole in the ice. The dark shape moves very slightly, a stretch Perhaps. The energy is languid, though his eyes are too far gone to be sure. He is aiming his gun before his mind knows he is aiming. The gun lets go its bullet with a sonorous bark. There is a cry across the ice, a broken noise. Terribly, terribly human.
Chapter 4. Towards the end of the summer, two important things occurred. The first thing, we were on our bikes and had stopped at some traffic lights when a motorbike sped across the road in front of us, a midnight blue metal blur. We were cycling home from an exhibition at the Natural History Museum. The motorbike was the first thing to distract him from the theory of evolution, about which he had produced some exceedingly early Victorian opinions. He said,
"Now there's a good reason to invent the internal combustion engine. Why is it so much faster than a delivery motorbike?"
"Different type of bike, I guess."
"And it is breaking no laws?"
"No."
"How fast can it go?"
"Now, look, you've only just learned how to ride a bike."
"Did Bellerophon, on seeing Pegasus, say, 'Oh, no thank you, terrestrial horses will be sufficient'?"
I emailed Quentin, guess what he wants now, and my email bounced back. The address autofilled and had always worked before. I tried several different iterations of ministry email domains. None of them delivered. While I was biting the skin off my thumb and rereading the undeliverable notice, I got a phone call on my work phone from an unknown number. All phones assigned to the project had private, protected numbers, and there was no way it could have been a spam call, or even a casual one. I picked up. On the other end was the Vice Secretary for Expatriation.
"Good afternoon," Adela said.
Her voice was quiet as cloth. She told me that my email had been forwarded to the finance department for approval, as Quentin was currently unavailable. "Where is—"
"Are you enjoying your work?"
she asked me. She sounded like she was reading from an auto cue that had been placed just beyond comfortable distance. It occurred to me this might be a delicately offered threat. I mumbled that I was very happy to be part of the project. After I hung up, a varnish of sweat in the palm of my hand, I opened my work laptop. Theoretically, I knew that my internal emails were monitored, but I'd only sent those messages 10 minutes beforehand, for Christ's sake. I deleted the harmless Google account I had been using in a Chrome browser, then I deleted the browser. It wasn't punishment I feared, so much as the disempowering effect of punishment. Every step in my career had been towards becoming the monitor rather than the monitored. It wasn't that I didn't have moral qualms, but I felt there was something sophomoric, unpragmatic, about raising personal qualms in the jaws of the state machine. And so, in the back of my mind, an hourglass turned. The second important thing that happened was the movement restrictions on the expats were conditionally lifted. If they could pass an examination set by control and demonstrate sufficient familiarity with the 21st century, then they had leave to travel within mainland Britain. Another time travel hypothesis from the early days of the project was that the dimensions of time and space were linked, not inextricably, but like a lymphatic and circulatory system. Both were needed for the universe to function in a way hospitable to human survival, and both could be fatally damaged at discrete points while the rest of the system appeared to function. We needed to see the expats move through broader geographical space without atomizing into the scenery, or the scenery atomizing around them, to know for sure that the 21st century had accepted their presence. The expats were envisioned as either foreign bodies against which the universe might launch an immune attack, or cells that could be recognized and incorporated by the systems into the body of the world. We used, once again, the word assimilation, but instead of survival, we meant a sort of sublimation, a permeable boundary between the individual and the world they'd entered. To belong, the hypothesis suggested, is to have a stake in the status quo. So I was anxious about Graham's disdain for the 21st century, because never mind that I felt rejected by it. I was worried that the universe would feel the atemporal sting of his contempt and take him away.
"My England wasn't like this,"
he'd told me. But this was the natural evolution of his England. I was the natural evolution. I was his lens if he would only raise me and look with me. Graham told me that when the conditional lift of the movement restrictions was announced to the expats, they'd started wagging their tails.
"Oh yes? Are you insinuating that you were exempt from tail wagging?"
"I was very restrained," I only jumped up and licked the man's face a little.
He pronounced this little with great tartness and vinegar. My nose went numb. I persuaded Graham to use the tiny office, in which I ordinarily worked, to cram for the test. The ministry gave no indication of what format the test would take, or what manner of questions would be asked, or tasks set. I thought this was unfair, and suggested as much to him.
Oh, it's not so different from the lieutenant's examinations. One had an idea of what one was expected to know, and the written portion was tolerable, but the oral portion depended on the mood of the men in front of you.
Were you nervous?
No, I was cocky, if you still use that word. I don't think you would have much liked me at 19.
We were having this conversation in the office. It was a tiny, south-facing room, stuffy in the August heat. In deference to the weather, he had rolled up his shirt sleeves, and the erotic charge of his bare forearms was giving me a headache. There were two pale brown beauty marks on the inside of his left arm, and a flimsy net of pink scars in the palm of his left hand. He filled the room like a horizon. At 37, he was only a little less cocky than he was at 19, but more adept at hiding it. He had made friends with a couple of the range masters and quartermasters at the ministry, and occasionally went down to the shooting ranges to unnerve the junior field agents by besting them in target practice. By the time of the examination, he was also cramming the highway code, determined as he was to get on a motorbike and make mischief outside the boundary lines. He was spending more time at the ministry, getting under people's feet and asking questions in that mild, impossible, unperturbable way of his. I had the feeling that I thought must afflict parents when their children start to grow apart and answer back. He was moving outside my observation, graduating from my guidance, fitting this new plastic world around him. The sunlight became acerbic. At midday, it shone down vertically, so that when I ventured onto the pavement, I walked into a world burned clean of shadows. I missed the shadows and the long English rains. The expats were still struggling. Graham moved into crisis management mode, though I'm sure he thought of it as keeping up his crew's morale. With the permission of control and with the help of administrative staff, he organized a series of lecture soirees. On Tuesday evenings, a member of the ministry would give a lecture on contemporary British culture, and then we'd all eat sandwiches with the crusts cut off and drink lemonade and rum punch. On Thursday evenings, one of the expats would give a short presentation on something that interested them, and then we'd all eat bits of ham with cocktail forks and drink tepid beer and lukewarm Coca-Cola. It freed Margaret from doing all the cooking for the group dinners, which was, by the way, what had happened. The ministry lectures were, to a sentence, dreadful. Control handed down a series of pre-written presentations, and they were so didactic as to be oppressive. They made me read a lecture on multiculturalism, the bastards, leaving blanks for insert own experience here. I gave it in a monotone without lifting my eyes from the page, then drank 250 milliliters of white wine at a quaff. Somelia gently clinked her full glass against my empty, her jaw set. She'd been asked to deliver a lecture on post-war migration from former colonies and the Windrush generation. Control's lectures were nakedly about getting the narrative right. In their much-edited correctness, their placid-voiced hectoring, they bankrupted the energy in the room. Ideas are frictional, factional entities which wilt when pinned to flowcharts. Ideas have to cause problems before they cause solutions. The expats did much better. Contrary to what the simple-minded among us had expected, they did not give presentations on their eras. Margaret, who had responded far better than Graham to the magic of cinema, amazed us by putting together an actual PowerPoint presentation about why Charlie Chaplin appears a fool but is verily a philosopher. Cardingham climbed the podium with soldierly grace, fixed us with a sneer and, in language even more obscure than Margaret's, delivered a summary of the Manson murders, which was also, somehow, a deranged excoriation of vegetarianism. His bridge, Ivan, was pulled into an emergency meeting the next day. Arthur Reginald Smith's presentation was the talk of the ministry. Reginald Smith was in his mid-30s and quite handsome, in a washed-out, wipe-clean Anglo-Saxon way. He was over 6 foot tall, but held himself as if he thought he should be shorter. He had a faint rhotic impediment, and his R's flattened into W's, which may be why his presentation went the way it did.
"Thank you all for coming," he said. "I'm afraid I'm a rotten public speaker, and so I won't be speaking this evening."
There was an embarrassed silence, then.
"Shame!"
yelled Margaret from the audience.
Fie, rhubarb, rhubarb, and divers other curses.
I flinched, but Reginald Smith smiled and made a sort of cheerful, fidgeting gesture, a bad actor ostentatiously preparing for his next line. There was a smattering of laughter as the audience realized they weren't about to watch an unwell man humiliate himself by running away. How strange that it hadn't occurred to me that the expats might be friends with each other, regardless of what I was doing.
Smellier, said Reginald Smith. Could you...
Smellier was leaning against the wall, by the door that led to the lecture theatre. She swung open the door with a fun little nudge of her hips, reached outside and pulled something in. It was a Casio keyboard, on wheels. Another amused, appreciative murmur ran around the auditorium. She helped Arthur lift it onto the stage.
47, said Reginald Smith.
Graham unfolded and ambled with studied nonchalance to the stage. He was holding what I briefly mistook for an épée, but was in fact his flute. He leapt lithely up, beside Reginald Smith, who was glowing rose and trying hard not to corpse.
We are going to offer you eine kleine, disco. We have rehearsed a little, said Graham, but not, I would say, copiously. We'd be telling you a tall one if we said copiously, said Reginald Smith. Indeed, or in fact, well. Yes, we have not rehearsed well, or much. We are fairly dreadful.
We are, Graham confirmed solemnly. Godspeed to you all.
They launched into a hornpipe, one that I'd heard Graham occasionally playing in the morning around the hour that he thought I should get out of bed. I didn't. But after a few bars, the song morphed into a Jackson 5 song. They were very good.
Rhubarb!
Margaret shouted again. There was more laughter, I felt, through the floor. A dozen feet began to tap. Samelia slid onto the seat next to me.
Hi,
she whispered.
Hey, you're not going to ask me to dance, are you?
Well, now you mention it.
In fact, there were a couple of members of the operative and administrative staffs hopping about in front of the stage, very young people who had been selected and fast-tracked from degrees at Oxford and Cambridge into the ministry. I wondered how scary their NDAs were. One of them looked like he'd heard the term throwing shapes and was trying out some interpretative mime to realize it. Samelia, in all other matters a restrained woman, couldn't resist a wiggle to a tune. She shoulder-bopped in her chair. I side-eyed her.
Did you know about this?
I whisper demanded.
Not until the last minute. They've been rehearsing in secret in a spare office.
They came and found me yesterday, after my catch-up with my handler, to ask for help setting up. I said.
They are likely to have asked me instead of you because they both know me.
And the situation is not a reflection on your relationship with 1847. Said Samelia, who, in addition to being enthralled to rhythm, was also enthralled to doing best practice at me.
Uh-huh. You should both come over sometime. We could play board games.
You do not want to play board games with me. I ruin every Christmas with Risk. Julius sees her, my family call me. There isn't a single board game you could name that I couldn't suck the fun out of.
Shall we dance?
Said Samelia, who had been watching the makeshift dance floor all through this intimate and vulnerable confession.
No. Come on, it'll be nice for Arthur.
No.
Oh, God! Samelia pulled me by the elbow towards where the back office staff were gyrating and started doing what I can only describe as cool mum at a concert swaying.
Yeah, get in, ladies,
yelled Ivan, earning an indelible presence on my shit list. I looked wildly around, because there was nowhere in the room to look at that wasn't, alas, in the room, which meant I was still in the room. I was in Graham's sightline, and I wanted to be eaten alive by a shark from the feet up.
Oh, who's that?
I said desperately. Samelia did an outrageous winding thing to follow my gaze.
You've not met Celise,
no?
Or, if I have,
why my feet?
I don't remember.
The person I was referring to was lurking at the far edge of the auditorium, with hair the colour of wet earth under moonlight and a pinched, unhappy expression. I don't think Celise could have looked more disapproving if we'd all started sucking at each other's fleshly parts and chanting, Hail Satan. The Brigadier was standing beside Celise. They were speaking, heads close together. They looked as if they were in an invisible bell jar of gloom which blocked out the room's miniature festivities.
They make me sad,
murmured Somelia. They weird me out.
Yes, that too.
Each presentation was half an hour long, so the nightmare was over before I started wondering whether I should suggest the electric slide.
Well done, said Somelia. You almost looked like you were about to start enjoying yourself.
For the most part, Somelia, I bow to your good judgment, but around anything with a rhythm, you seem to think we're in a musical.
There is no revolution without joy, said Somelia.
She'd switched back to her reflective counselor voice and seemed to be about to impart a life lesson. I wondered how many times she'd advised the radicalized teenagers she'd worked with in Kooks and Killers to keep a list of things they were grateful for, though I recognized the thought as spiteful.
Oh, I don't know about that, I said. I'd asked 1793 about revolutions and the joy therein.
Anyway, what revolution? We work for the government. Graham and Reginald Smith had clambered down from the stage and were standing just at the periphery of our conversation.
Good lecture, I said.
Unique. You did wonderfully, said Somelia.
Thank you, murmured Reginald Smith. The old light fantastic tripping was much appreciated.
Yes, tripping is how I'd put it, said Somelia.
I moved slightly sideways to jab her in her ribs. I said, Cambodia holds the Guinness World Record for the largest Madison dance in the world, I'll have you know. I mean, I wasn't there, but I'm claiming it.
That's jolly nice, said Reginald Smith. What's a Madison?
What's a Guinness?
Asked Graham. The Madison is a line dance. It got very popular in Cambodia in the 1960s and never stopped being popular. Well, except during the... Anyway, my parents had a couple of Madison dancers at their wedding, I'm told. My mother's great at dancing. When she was a little girl, she wanted to learn traditional folk dance, but she was sent to a lycée in Phnom Penh, and it wasn't on the curriculum. Quelle surprise.
A lycée?
Reginald Smith echoed politely. During my speech, he had looked more at sea than perhaps even Graham had been as a lifelong career sailor. A French school. Cambodia used to be a French protectorate. My grandfather was in politics, and he wanted her to be évoluée, evolved, to the French system. Neither the Victorian nor the Edwardian seemed surprised by this, though Somelia breathed deeply through her nose. Graham and Reginald Smith wandered off to get their fair share of the room's congratulations. Somelia said,
My mother liked a party too. She used to organize the Easter ball for our church.
She had turned to look at the clock on the far wall, so I couldn't see her expression, but I heard the way her voice shivered on the past tense.
Evolue,
she muttered.
Remind me to lend you my France, Fanon.
I won't.
Another do-good second gen whose mother used to party, huh? Does this country have a factory setting for them, or what?
Well, we've both got eldest daughter disease,
said Somelia, turning back to me.
My siblings went in other directions. My brother's in the music business, and my sister makes fancy cakes. They call me the cop. Every time I ring up my brother, he goes, Hello, officer. When he was a bit younger, he used to call me Babylon, but he stopped when I threatened to tell his producer he'd gone to private school.
I laughed and let Somelia slip her arm through mine. I was thinking, two siblings, dead mother, no mention of her dad as yet. Put that in the file and remember it. And I was thinking, why is it always the eldest daughters? I never did read the Fanon, though I don't think I would have understood it. I didn't understand that my value system, my great inheritance, was a system, rather than a far point on a neutral, empirical line that represented progress. Things were easier for me than for my mother. Things were easier for me than for my father. My drugs were cleaner. My goods were abundant. My rights were enshrined. Was this not progress? I struggled with the same bafflement over history, which I still understood in rigid, narratively linear terms. I should have listened more carefully to Adela about history. I know Adela would say the same. I travelled in with Graham for his acclimatization examination in hopes of seeing Quentin, whose phone no longer connected. We'd both become habitual cyclist commuters, but on that day, we took the tube, imagining it would be less sweaty. Foolish, guileless us. The tube was a sauna in August. For the examination, he'd put on a suit, 60s style, slim cut, painfully becoming. He was suffering.
If I expire, will you bury me at sea?
I promise. Irish? Channel? Atlantic?
Arctic, he said, maudlin. At least it's cooler there.
Take your jacket off.
Believe me when I say that you do not want me to take my jacket off.
I wished him luck at the staff entrance and watched him pass a handkerchief over his sweat-damp curls. I walked up to Quentin's office, but it was empty. Not even a laptop charger remained. I put my head around the aquarium door of another handler, formerly a member of the intelligence services, assigned to Thomas Cardingham's team.
Sadavir!
Hey, how are you doing? Heard your expat's taking the exam today.
Yep, he's confident, I think.
Seems he's adjusting well.
Idiosyncratically, but well.
He killed all the squirrels in the garden. And he won't watch TV. Uppity bastard.
Could be worse. Our boy's mainly interested in Minecraft and sex workers. It's been a real fucking pain to get that squared on the budget.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Quentin's been on at me to get 1847 to cut down on smoking.
How is Quentin? I heard he was reassigned. Is that what's happened?
Sedavia frowned and stood up. For a moment, I thought he was about to reprimand me for losing track of my handler, which surely was my handler's responsibility, not mine. But I realized he was directing the frown over my shoulder. I turned.
I hope I am not disturbing you.
The brigadier stood in the doorway, accompanied by Celise.
Can we help you, sir?
Sedavia asked, stepping in front of me.
I'm looking for the vice secretary. I have heard there have been some issues with one of your free travellers.
Do you mean the expats?
Yes, said Celise quickly.
That's meant. We reck see her.
We would like to see her,
the brigadier said. I tried to catch Sadavir's eye, but he was looking between the brigadier and Celise.
I hope you understand why I am asking, sir, he said. But could I see some identification?
The brigadier pulled a ministry-issue ID card from his pocket and handed it to Sadavir. He was looking worse than when I last saw him. He had that ineffable air of someone who has to boil hot water in a stove for bathing, which was surely incompatible with his rank. He saw me staring, and I lowered my eyes. Sadavir handed the ID back.
Vice Secretary Adela is in a control meeting, he said carefully. And so, of course, none of us know where she is, exactly.
But yes, the meeting is about 1793 proving the space-time hypothesis right. The 21st century appears to be rejecting her.
This was in the reports to defence, sir,
he added reproachfully.
Oh, it's not the century. It's the soul, said the brigadier. Her here-ness and there-ness have no consistency, no continency, and she is beginning to slip out of time. It is unusually accelerated in 1793. She does not even try to bring her there-ness in line, you see, because she is grieving, and grief will always take one out of time.
Sedavir looked worried.
Is that what defence think? He said. Have you told the vice secretary? I'm afraid I've only ever met the secretary, said the brigadier, but I would very much like to meet Vice Secretary Adela.
He considered me again, cold and curious. I felt a boyishness around him, not playfulness or youthfulness, of which he had neither, rather the quality of his focus, which was as intense as a child experimenting dispassionately with the limbs of a pet to see how far they turned before they broke. I went home and, on arrival, checked my emails. As with the driving test or the lieutenant's exam, the acclimatization exam results were delivered immediately. Graham had passed. I cycled up to the nice grocery store to buy a bottle of champagne, pausing on the way home for a soft-serve ice cream. I sat on the bench to lick the ripple into a mound and think about the brigadier. A man of bivouac experience, I felt. There was something disturbingly makeshift about both him and Celise, as if they'd been dropped behind enemy lines and were mimicking familiarity while waiting for the right moment to cut a throat. Despite the group dinners, despite the empathy exams and the language tests and the jolly little flat with Ed, the jolliest and youngest of the Bridges, the ministry had more or less agreed that Anne Spencer, 1793, was a failed experiment and probably dying. Her blank MRI scan was one of many examples Ed had glumly filed of her body failing to register with modern technology before he was stood down. She was invisible in recorded time to all things but the naked eye. The brigadier's contention that this invisibility was internally rather than externally wrought was interesting. It might bring a new facet to identity politics. What time are you? Are you multi-temporal or stuck in a time warp?
Or maybe a mismatch of internal and external experiences of time was more like carrying cancerous cells. Do you have the time, we could ask, and mean, do you think you'll survive? I finished my ice cream and watched the evening slide around. The sun started slipping off the sky and breezes patchworked the air. By the time I'd cycled back, Graham had returned. He had stacked several ice cube trays and was taking them upstairs. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Bought this to celebrate.
What a kind thought.
Where are you taking those ice cubes?
I am going to have the coldest bath that modern technology can muster.
If I put this in the freezer for 15 minutes, do you want a glass in the bath? I can leave it outside the door.
You are a dreadful decadent. Yes, please. I am also going to smoke half a packet of cigarettes, I think. One after the other.
They gave you a grilling then?
Apparently, I can pass as an eccentric. I suggested that somewhere like Scotland, Arthur and I might simply pass as Englishmen. One of the panel was a Scotsman, and I think he liked that.
When I brought the glass up, stoppering the rest of the bottle for dinner, I could hear Graham singing I Love to Steal a While Away, occasionally muffled by his drags on a cigarette. Water plashed against the tub. He dropped to humming and presumably soaping. I slid quietly to the floor and leant my head against the wall. I wasn't going to see a ministry therapist. I knew I should, and I knew I wouldn't. The following week, we had Margaret and Captain Reginald Smith over for dinner. Graham decided to make a spaghetti bolognese, as we both reasoned that it was easy, delightful, and modern. With the exception of naval rations meted out during Discovery Service expeditions, cooked over campfires and valued for their fuel rather than their flavour, Graham had never so much as heated a bowl of soup before arriving in the 21st century. On ships, there were cooks and officers' stewards. At home, on the few occasions he was at home, there were women. Nevertheless, he had taken to cooking in a way he had failed to take to television or texting or the use of deodorants.
I bathe every day, he said to me with hurt dignity.
Tonight, he hummed with a busyness that hardly shielded nervousness. He burned the onions and automatically reached for his cigarettes. I took them away. I didn't want ashy bolognese. And he accused me of nanny-stating him. A turn of phrase I found very alarming, because I certainly hadn't taught it to him. Where was he picking this stuff up? The doorbell rang while the sauce was reducing. He handed me the wooden spoon and went to answer the door.
Hello, 16. Hello, 65. Welcome.
47, exclaimed Margaret. This is a bold adventure. I arrived on a bus.
Evening, 47,
I heard Reginald Smith say.
That smells nice. Kind of you to say so. I'm afraid I'm going to have to get you both very drunk. I'm not much of a cook.
He brought them into the kitchen. Margaret was wearing high-waisted cerulean bell-bottoms and a white blouse clocked with lace. She looked like a disco goddess, an astonishing concoction given that she was only barely older than the piano, never mind the synth. Hello, I said, stunned.
Hello,
she said in her unplaceable accent, and surged into my arms. She beamed up at me and I must have swallowed loud enough for my throat to click in her ear because she said,
Am I mistaken? I have seen folk do greet each other like this, though 47 will not let me.
No, this is fine. Feel free to stay here. I'll have his hug for him, Reginald Smith.
Call me Arthur.
For went the hug and shyly shook my hand.
Whipping to see you,
he murmured. He pronounced this in a way that was close to whipping, and I saw Graham suppress a twinkle. I dropped the wooden spoon back into the pan and said, Would you like a martini? It's the only drink I know how to mix. This is a classy household.
Classy?
Asked Margaret.
Fine and noble, here applied mockingly, said Arthur. As you should know of any household that contains 47. Belike I'll be fluent after a classy martini.
I like those trousers, I said to her.
Many thanks. I do like the zipper. See?
She demonstrated unzipping her pockets.
The time I might have saved on trussing myself in stays had I but a single zipper. Did you have the zipper?
No,
said Graham.
No, though they were coming into use in my time.
They are a goodly invention.
A little dangerous, sometimes, said Arthur carefully, dependent on their placement.
He caught Graham's eye and they grinned sheepishly at each other. Graham forgot to put the spaghetti on, and Margaret started hiccuping at the first mouthful of her martini. The men smoked copiously in our not-over-large kitchen, and I'd forgotten to wash up all the matching plates. Nevertheless, the little party was very pleasant. I opened a bottle of wine, Margaret couldn't finish her martini, and we toasted the only thing we could all agree was good about 21st century Britain. Music, when you damn well wanted it. They were friends, I saw, not incidentally, but real friends. Margaret had tried to befriend Anne Spencer, but had been thwarted by her reticence and by what Margaret called her sorrows. Margaret loathed Cardingham, and Arthur stiffly referred to him as a difficult chap. This interested me, as Graham often boxed with him.
He is a pizzle-headed doorknob, said Margaret.
Very colourful, said Graham. But he is as stranded as we all.
I don't know, 47, said Arthur. I don't particularly want to spend my rescued life around him.
He must be returned to the cowpat whence they dragged him.
How do you stand him, Grey?
One develops a great deal of patience at sea.
You make the navy sound like the priesthood, said Arthur.
Hmm. Arthur was happy and flushed. He was one of those unusual extroverts who have all the attributes of an introvert, save that they like being around other people. He had a gift for gentleness, too, one of the rarest virtues in any gender, and especially in the kind of man Arthur was supposed to be. I eased some biography out of him. Half-decent public school, classics at Oxford, where he'd had a lot of fun and failed his exams. Retraining as a doctor.
Came a cropper there, too,
he added. Not good with wiggly internals and so on, I asked.
No, I qualified all right. But I didn't much care for the other chaps. Brutish breed. The profession makes a man hard in the heart, or it did in my time. They get rather superior. You can't be superior about other people's pain. I threw that in after a few years. Started over in the Raj. Some schoolfellow of my father got me a job. Oversaw the building of some unwanted railways, which benefited nobody but the company. A dreadful stuff. I was transferred to our London office about 6 months before Germany invaded Belgium.
I saw Graham's eyebrow quirk in a rascally way as he did the maths.
You became a captain extremely quickly, 16. Found your forte?
Arthur grimaced. I saw his hand shiver momentarily on his glass, and then he swallowed everything in it with a wet click.
Promotion was fast in the war,
he said shortly. He added that he probably would have been happy as a teacher or a vicar, but he'd come from the sort of family where the former was an embarrassment and the latter a punchline. I filed these desires away as professionalized fatherhood. Some days later, taking a long lunchtime walk around Bloomsbury with Somelia, she described Arthur as having a deeply moral sense of his duty of care, and I felt ashamed of my absent-minded cruelty to someone I had liked. Margaret, incidentally, listened to the men talk about their careers with a suffused urgency that only I noticed. In her own era, she'd slept in the room next to the one where she had been born. She thought Scotland was far-flung and semi-barbaric. When we came round to talking about my time working as a translator in Cambodia, I felt her attention all over me like a flannel. I may have talked slightly too much. How the topic of weed came up, I couldn't remember. Probably during one of the vigorous debates about what the 21st century had genuinely improved, which in the opinion of the expats was a mixed bag. I was shortly handing my grinder and papers to Graham, who was far more adept at rolling. Meeting Margaret made me vivid and receptive. Sentences weighed more. I kept a half-conscious catalogue of where the men were looking. I've seen people deal with this in different ways. By this, I mean power. I mean magnetism. I tried to absorb it. Within 20 minutes, Margaret and I were planning a girls' take Soho night out, which necessitated me explaining the history of Soho, the concept of clubbing, the genre R&B, the club night R&She, and dancing. I hadn't been clubbing since I was an assistant in languages. No matter.
I know a little of the pavan and the jig, but if there will be only women...
You really don't need to worry about that. You just sort of throw yourself around and wiggle.
I would like to be thrown,
she said wistfully. Here, I'll teach you the electric slide.
I say, that looks fun,
said Arthur.
What's it called? The electrical slide.
He was swaying, and his oddly seductive roticism had intensified. Graham pinched the joint out of his fingers.
Don't encourage them, 16. I'm going to open another bottle of wine. I've had enough of the poker. I want to learn the electrical slide.
What manner of dance is a poker?
Asked Margaret, breathlessly mid-slide. Ask 47 to teach you, I think they had it in his time.
I will not be press-ganged into dancing, thank you, Graham said, and slid with the bottle of wine off to the left.
Hey, you can dance.
Such matters are between myself and God, he said gravely. Oh, stop frowning, 65. Arthur, will you please lead her in a poker, if you can still stand?
Arthur got up and we exchanged a sort of maddened camp, bowing exchange of Margaret between us. But as soon as she was gathered into Arthur's arms, I started to laugh helplessly. Margaret barely came to his shoulder.
Oh, God, you look like a handsome giraffe, Miss Tiny Rabbit Wife. Oh, God.
You take her, 47.
Excuse me.
Here, I don't dance. I took up the flute especially in order that no one would ask me.
In this age, musicians are imprinted inside music boxes, and there is no need for the band to keep time, said Margaret. You will instruct me in the poker, or I will step on your toes.
I think feminism has gone to your head. Ow! May I have this dance?
Arthur asked me. Graham had never, even pulling out my chair in restaurants, even handing me plates in the kitchen, deliberately touched me. It was strange to see him handle Margaret. My heart was careening in a way that felt inextricable from a good time. I pulled up to Arthur. I'll teach you some swing dance, I said. I had a terrible ex-boyfriend who was very into Lindy Hop, and he used to drag me out to lessons with him, so I have to pass the talent on like a curse.
I understood at least half of those words. I've known men like that, who lead one in a merry dance.
I looked at Arthur thoughtfully. I'd accidentally caught his eye a number of times that evening. On reflection, every time it had happened, it was because our glances had both been resting on Graham. At the other end of the kitchen, I heard Graham saying,
Your other left.
Go to. Why do you not instruct more levelly?
Why do you keep trying to lead? No, 65, your other left.
You are a terrible teacher.
I don't dance. Ow!
Arthur, by contrast, danced beautifully. He dipped me and I bent like a reed. He spun me and I was, with such satisfaction, spun.
Why, Captain, you've got fresh and funky before.
My dear lady, we invented the fresh and the funky.
There must have been something in our movement or the music that triggered a memory of the trenches or something else. An agony in Arthur that was unrelated to the brief bloody corridor of the war. We'd finished the joint long enough ago that it can't have been the vertigo nausea of a bad reaction. Whatever it was, it came over him like a call. Without any warning, he blanched, and I felt a slick cold sweat transfer from his palm to my waist. Arthur? I said, at the same time Graham said,
16?
Arthur passed a shaking hand across his forehead. His breath was coming in short bursts.
Oh, forgive. It's too warm in here, said Graham.
He'd drawn Arthur from my grasp and was steering him towards the kitchen door.
Let's sit outside and have a cigarette. I need to rest my feet. Maggie flattened them.
Arthur wheezed in a way that passed as a laugh. He was high-shouldered and skittish in Graham's careful grip, and then he was suddenly slumped against him, his face turned against Graham's ear.
Tobacco deprivation is very dangerous, said Graham. Be careful of the step.
I felt Margaret squirrel her hand into mine. Graham shot me a look, in fact, a look, and the weight of its exchange pulled my heart upwards. I asked Margaret if she had been introduced to the phenomenon of modern makeup and took her up to my room. As soon as she stepped in, I started making a tally of the evidence of unbeauty. There was a chair whose seat was filled with clothes too dirty for the wardrobe, but too clean for the washing basket. My bedside table sprouted two water glasses and a mug. Dust crouched on the skirting boards and in the seams of my chest of drawers. When a woman is as impossibly attractive as Margaret, the mediocrity shed by a woman like me bustles around her like a horde of pigeons. Or so I thought at that time. Truthfully, I'd been foxed by how beautiful she was. I felt a complicated anguish when I saw her little besocked toes treadling the carpet. Margaret appeared unaware of any of these concerns. She didn't even glance at herself in the mirror. She gave me an interested grin as I pulled out my lipsticks.
Oh,
What manner of material makes this color?
I have no idea.
I do not think I have seen such color. 'Tis very dramatic.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure why I own blue lipstick. Here, try this pink. It doesn't suit me. It makes me look a bit green.
It matches with my pustules, she said sadly.
She had a bijou constellation of acne across her forehead and cheeks. She made acne look chic.
Oh, well, there's foundation for that. Look.
I'd stopped wearing it. I was, at the time, thinking of the way my face might be received by a Victorian who didn't approve of cosmetics. But I demonstrated the coverage of my sole foundation. Margaret was amazed by the smoothness of its application and the faithfulness of its shade. She drew an arrow with it on her cheek. On her fair skin, it looked like clay. We started giggling. By and by, the drink and the weed overtook us. We took the conversation to a horizontal position, struggling as we both were with articulation and uprightness. We lay face to face on the bed, woozy and languid. I had an obscure sense that I had won something, though whether from Margaret, off Graham, or within myself, I wasn't sure.
You're pretty,
I said.
You are pretty.
Feel a bit tired.
Are you Graham's mistress?
No. God. No.
Just his bridge.
Oh,
she said, and fell asleep. I began to doze. I didn't know how much time passed, but I came to when I heard his voice.
Check on Maggie and the Moggy.
The door to my bedroom creaked.
Your bridge is very kind. Strange, though, for a bridge. She's a strange woman. Ah, oh, leave them, Grey. All things. The degeneracy of this era. They have not even taken down their hair.
The door grumbled shut, and I fell back into a doze. Margaret was snoring lightly, like a puppy being squeezed. The door reopened, and I surfaced to vague consciousness. I felt a wave of cool air, and then a gentle warmth. He had spread a blanket over the pair of us. The next morning, Margaret and I woke up with no voices. We crept downstairs together for tea and toast. When we got to the kitchen, we found that the men had done the washing up. Autumn set in like a decorative inlay. The trees wilted and dropped leaves. Leaden clouds enameled the sky and the wind picked up all over the city. Graham and Arthur had decided to go to Scotland for the stag season, partly so that they could experience a domestic flight. They flew to Aberdeen, watched by the ministry. They were shadowed by field agents, but once the pair got to the tiny Highlands town where they were staying, the ministry had to call the shadows off. The town was the sort of quiet, close-knit place, but the locals were wary of suspicious characters with no obvious purpose. All the expats had phones, paid for and tapped, by the ministry. Graham had switched his own phone on a total of 3 times in the 7 months he had been in the 21st century. I was therefore unsurprised when, about half an hour after their plane landed, I got a call from Arthur's phone.
Hi, Arthur.
It's me. 16 is clinging to a wall.
Oh, hello. How was your first flight?
It was both extraordinary and terribly mundane. Though I'm afraid Arthur and I nearly broke one another's hands during takeoff.
Did your ears pop?
Yes, very strange. But the aeroplane took us above the clouds. They were beneath us like a mattress. They looked almost solid.
Fun fact, the average cloud weighs about 551 tons.
That is a fun fact.
You didn't have any trouble at the airport?
The machine that reads bodies stopped working when I passed through it.
Reads? Oh, the body scanner. It didn't go off.
Some airport officer had to manhandle me to ensure I was not carrying weapons. In full view of everyone, my honour has been impugned.
Oh dear.
Now you're spoiled. No one will ever take me as a wife.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Somehow I will bear it stoically. Now I must go, because if I don't smoke a cigarette soon, I'm going to bite through a wall.
After the call, I turned on my laptop to check the Teams channel. Me, Quentin, Control, the wellness team, and the administrative staff assigned to Expat 1847. The field agents had already filed an alert about the body scanner failing to read Graham. Recommend returning expats to base, one of the agents had written. I thought about the boyish grin on Graham's face when he came home after passing the exam, his high-spirited singing in the bath. I typed fast. Overcorrecting out of cautiousness will be as damaging to his adjustment as forcing him home. His readability has not, hitherto, been a cause of concern. Then, in the private conversation with Quentin, he's gone through the scanners at the staff entrance with no problem, right? Most of the time. Quentin's status was invisible. It had been for a while. In the main channel, a member of Graham's wellness team was agreeing with me. His read rate average is 86% and has been since records started. By far the highest of all the expats. We don't want to risk alienating him and impacting that average. Records started 2 weeks ago, the agent typed. Several people started typing, but stopped when Adela, whose status was also invisible, dropped. According to your report, 1916 followed 1847 and was temporarily unreadable, subsequently readable. Suggests deliberate attempts to test readability. Do not interfere. Expats will be monitored on their return. The conversation ended there. Adela could do barking over a meeting, even over text. Thank you, I said out loud. I slammed the laptop shut. After that, I drifted through the house like a purposeless balloon. In truth, I was purposeless. My job for the bridge year was to watch him, and he was not there to be watched. I went into his room. He was a neat man, used to the limited space of a cabin at sea, and there wasn't much to see. I sat on the very edge of the bed. It was a double, and I knew from past conversations that he slept like a dropped twig at one far end of it, accustomed as he was to ship's berths. I didn't rummage through his drawers for his journal, or sketches, or push my face into his clothes. I acted as if watched by an invisible audience, who were checking for signs of mania. A few days after he and Arthur had left England, Somelia paid me an unannounced visit. She came in the wake of a new project-wide working group on readability and the Brigadier's concepts of here-ness and there-ness. This was a development of such significance that the Secretary had been forced to chair a working group, announcing, glassy of voice and face, that while bridge work wasn't changing, the wellness team would be running some tests on the expats, monitoring vitals and responses under standard and stressor conditions. Sounds a bit MK-Ultra, I'd ventured.
Unprecedented in the history of the world, etc.,
he told the air to the left of my head. Oh, Somelia, hi.
Hello. Hope I'm not disturbing you. I wanted to see how you were doing since Quentin's reassignment.
Yes, of course. Come in. I put the kettle on and made a performance of biscuits. The air around us flexed with expectation. I said, can't believe we're dealing with the long dark time travel of the soul, or whatever defense think there-ness is. Quite a change from kooks and killers, eh?
We tend not to use that nickname in the department.
I winced. She added, not unkindly,
you know how it is. I'm sure you're tired of people making jokes about Google Translate.
I suppose so. Hilda's okay?
Yes, thanks.
Am I right in thinking that your grandfather was a governor of the rainforests in Cambodia or something like that? I made an audible syllable of surprise, which was drowned out by the kettle. I was always on amber alert, minimum, when people asked about my heritage with any taxonomic specificity. I never knew what they were hoping to do with it. My sister described these interactions as microaggressions, as if she didn't talk about her Cambodian heritage at every possible opportunity. I probably had her latest essay published in an online magazine the previous week about the psychic horror of passing as white to blame for Somelia's question. My sister and I shared the same bizarre Eurasian double-barreled surname, so we were easy to link. I sometimes wondered if my sister had decided to develop daddy issues about our long-dead Cambodian grandfather, because our father was a nice, quiet, white guy who liked afternoon naps, making long lists and curating complete sets of things. Stamps, DVDs, limited edition fountain pens. He was not someone you could have an interesting and publishable psychological complex about. My grandfather was governor of Siem Reap until he was dismissed in 1955, I said. I guess there are a lot of rainforests in the province. But if you know that, I expect you know what happened to him.
Disappeared.
I felt her gaze through my hair.
I know that was a bizarre thing to bring up,
she said. It was pretty spicy.
It's just that, given your family history, I suppose I'm a bit surprised by your choice of career. Your time in languages, it's all a bit, dare I say it, post-colonial. Are you hoping that the time door will...
Adela said that you can't change the past. You can only change the future.
That's wordplay. Changing the past is changing the future. Your girl just means that the past exists the way she says it exists. Have you managed to get your commander to stop calling me a negress, by the way?
She was smiling as she spoke. But as Somelia often smiled, even when she was angry, I dropped into a crouch, spiritually. I'm so sorry.
What for?
I thought it might be callow to say, for the existence of racism. I ummed and erred and eventually said, if it's any consolation, he has asked me, straight of face as you like, about being half-caste.
Is that a consolation?
No sugar, thanks. I put the tea bags on the sideboard. A pad of hard water scum disported across the top of my mug.
I appreciate, I said slowly, that this project is more fraught for you than anyone else. Stop hand-wringing,
said Somelia, still smiling, though increasingly looking as if the smile was being operated by winches inside her skull.
God, ministry bias training has a lot to answer for, she said. I don't want to drop a piano on your head, but believe it or not, I already know I'm black. You don't have to roll over and show me your belly about it.
I put the tea down in front of her. I'm sorry if I said something that upset you, I said.
You haven't upset me. You're just boring me.
Okay.
Okay. I bet you had a tumbler.
That made me laugh, albeit nervously. Somelia's smile loosened a bit.
Called it, she said. I bet you put up a Black Lives Matter reading list.
I sat down. I had, in fact, shared someone else's reading list. But she could have me lick the floor clean of germs before I'd admit it right then. Somelia, I said, has something happened? Somelia rolled her shoulders. She seemed discomforted in her own immaculate costume.
Yes, she said finally. Do you remember when you told the secretary that you were finding the whole proposed readability monitoring a bit MK Ultra? It got me thinking about what we're doing with the expats. I'm a clinical professional. I'm supposed to be governed by a code of ethics.
What about the rest of us? She hadn't touched her tea.
What about the rest of you? She said.
Hello, officer.
Stop it,
she said, far more sharply than she'd ever spoken to me.
Take things seriously for a moment.
I bristled, not visibly, not readably, but inside me I felt the spikes slide out. I should have ended the conversation there. Spikes under the skin, that angry internal prickle. I hated to have the lower hand, and I've never been good at managing it graciously. I'm not going to insult you by feeding you aphorisms about omelets and broken eggs, I said. But you signed up for this job. You thought, as much as I did, that what we were doing was world-changing. That's what you wanted, remember? Do you think the world changes by being asked politely? Or do you think there has to be risk? She took a deep breath. All the emotions I normally watched her puree into professionalism were churning on her face.
I came here, she said, because I thought you would understand.
Don't you?
Being the experiment. Being the pioneer they break the concepts on. The first. Are there any other Cambodians on the core team? Any other Southeast Asians, even? I can tell you exactly how many black people there are. And I'd only need one hand to count them off.
I leant back in my chair. She wasn't telling me off, and yet I felt scolded. She reminded me of my sister sometimes. Somelia, I said, I'm not a victim. I don't give people an excuse to make me a victim. I'd advise you not to give them the opportunity either. Somelia stared. The emotion in her face spiraled away, watered down a plug hole. She stood up.
Thanks for the tea, she said coldly.
I let her leave without saying goodbye and sat in the pool of silence that followed the crash of the front door slamming shut. This was one of my first lessons in how you make the future. Moment by moment, you seal the doors of possibility behind you.
5.
Your feet are swelling, good sir observes.
Gore is back in the sickbay on Erebus. Stanley is tearing at his cuffs, bellowing for hot water. Gore's frostnip isn't close to the worst cold-induced injury the crew has seen. It isn't even the worst Gore has personally endured. But Stanley's panic is bracketed by the report Gore has just made.
You're quite sure you shot him dead?
Lieutenant Le Visconte, the second lieutenant, asks. He is a veteran of the Opium War, cool and soldier-like, and like all soldierly men, given to tenderness about bloodshed. In the same dry tone, good sir says,
Mr. Gore never misses.
Gore is grateful for the assistant surgeon's ironic calm. Good sir is his friend, insofar as a commander and a lesser sawbones can be friends. No, that's not fair. They are friends. Good sir is a career scientist. If they had figs on board, he wouldn't give them for the gold epaulettes on Gore's shoulders.
I thought he was a SEAL, says Gore. Poor devil. I ran over as soon as I heard him shout.
He was absolutely dead,
Le Visconte asks again. He sounds like someone's peeled the skin off his voice.
Yes. Send a couple of men out to the body, says Gore. Take tobacco, steel knives if we can spare any. Something we can leave that makes it clear we mean no further harm. Don't interfere with the corpse in any way.
I'd be hesitant to arm those people, Graham, mutters Le Visconte, in the circumstances.
Tobacco, then. Mr. Goodsir?
Sir.
Can I walk on these?
Goodsir gives Gore's feet an appraising glance. He takes one swollen arch and chafes it briskly.
I know it doesn't matter what I say, he says. You're going to walk on them anyway.
Well done.
Gore begins to cram his feet back into his boots. His gloves are by his thigh on the table. They have a brownish crust on them. The Eskimo had bled through his furs. By the time Gore had reached his side, his eyes were already cloudy.
I shot him through the heart, Harry, he says vaguely.
Good sir doesn't respond, but he squeezes Gore's arm.
What for?
Gore checks his inner machinery as he would a chronometer. Is that a feeling, sculling at the basin of his ribs? Does he need comforting? Topside, the watch begins to stamp and shout, a tattoo of boots on the ladderway. Someone has sighted a party of Eskimo, moving towards the ships.